this is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO Files program. The most talked about UFO book of the year, no doubt, is Witness to Roswell by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. We have half of that writing team back for a follow-up interview to the one we did in Roswell. Don Schmidt, you actually have been at the Roswell story a little longer than Tom, isn't that right?
Yeah, actually started... We actually had our first meeting at the Center for UFO Studies when I was still on the board of directors in the fall of 1988, and was very skeptical on the case and kind of tossed it around whether we should actually conduct an independent investigation of 1947 or not. And that was even after having met with Stan Friedman and his admitting me at that time that, yeah, there were still many potential witnesses still out there, still people that should be tracked down, should get them on the record and, you know, find out what really happened out there. And, again, we thought this would be a single weekend jaunt down to New Mexico and wrap this up. You know, either come away convinced it was nothing more than a weather balloon or something else just as conventional. And we would make that trip in February of 1989. And we couldn't have been more wrong. Because as most people know, we come away, you know, almost 100% convinced that as the witnesses are describing to us, that this was something truly extraordinary. That after now 60 years, and the government still defies, you know, the demands of the witnesses, the families of the witnesses, in wanting the files released, wanting there to be full disclosure.
How did Tom become involved with you? Through the UFO Museum or what?
No, actually, when...
The reason I'm asking this is, you know, when you write in conjunction with somebody else, it... It can be either really beneficial or it can be tough, and you guys seem to be a pretty good team.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And with Kevin, Rando and I originally, we were often accused of playing good cop, bad cop. And I guess that would be the case very often with the witness.
Yeah, I had Kevin on right after that book you guys did way back here, 89.
Two books, UFO Crash and Rock, right. The second one being The Truth About the UFO Crash.
And the reason I mentioned that is I assume Kevin was the bad cop.
No, I'll be quite honest with you, Jerry. Very often I was accused of being the bad cop. I guess it would depend on the witness. And to be honest with you, that was not even our intent.
That wasn't your modus of operation.
No. It would often fall into that situation, and it would work for us. With Tom and I, when Kevin and I were exploring this idea or this story that there were archaeologists involved, that they somehow had stumbled upon the crash site and had actually observed the remains of the craft and the bodies. And in fleshing out that very storyline, Tom Carey had come forward, and as an anthropologist, as someone who was just a dissertation away from a PhD in anthropology. And the original story was that this was a group of archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania, no less. Well, and Tom happens to reside right outside of Philadelphia. So it became perfect. Originally, Tom focused strictly on the archaeologists. And after eliminating the University of Pennsylvania, we then obviously attempted to determine, first of all, if there was an archaeological team out there and where they were from. And Tom was the one who, mainly through a process of elimination, it couldn't have been this university, it couldn't have been this group, it couldn't have been, you know, this group of students from this place or that place. And that's how he got caught up in the whole Roswell investigation. And started with Kevin and I, and then after Kevin and I parted company, Tom and I continued and have been working on this together since 1998.
The reason I bring up this now, really ancient history in many ways, not as ancient as 47, that's one of the big problems here. It's taken 60 years. And we'll get into maybe memories and events and whether time is an ally or not before the show's over. But basically, the reason I brought up this history of your investigation is I'm very curious about one thing, just as an interviewer. Did the witnesses become easier to talk to as time went on? In other words, were they more open in 2007 than they were in 1998 or in 1989?
That's a good question, and I think it's a bit of a misnomer, as demonstrated with the release of the new book. We have seen that very often the book is being promoted, content, the new witnesses in the book have come forward as though they now are, you know, gleefully stepping out or from the closet witnesses to Roswell, presenting all this new information, and that is not, and it never has been the case at all. In fact, if anything, whenever a witness has, you know, actually contacted us, that typically was a red flag. Someone who more times than not was looking for notoriety.
Right. A lot of people over the years have inserted themselves in this story.
Precisely. But we have always, you know, found that our best witnesses have been the most reluctant. The ones that we had to gain the confidence of, that we've had to go back to, not only weekly, but even monthly and yearly. There have been witnesses that it has literally taken us years to get to finally go on the record. Now, granted, when the Secretary of the Air Force, in September of 1994, to the Pentagon press conference regarding Project Mogul, announced that they were absolving all of the Air Force witnesses of their security oaths regarding Roswell. Well, to us, you know, we immediately recognize that as a bit of a red herring because, first of all, there was no Air Force in July of 1940.
We all get in that trap.
How does the Air Force absolve another branch of the military, and that being the Army at that time, of a security oath? But yet we've still used it because many of those personnel obviously went on to become Air Force. And it has worked to our benefit at times when we present them, you know, that release. And it relaxes them. It enables them at least to come forward and join this legion of others who, albeit reluctantly, have stepped forward.
Yeah, you know, Don, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but the thing that it puzzles me, I guess, or one of the things about the story that intrigues me is probably a better term, is the fact, are these people reluctant witnesses because of the security problems, or are they reluctant witnesses because it's just such a phenomenal, outlandish story to many people?
It's quite clear that these people have been sworn to secrecy. That is one of the benchmarks. Major Edwin Easley, who retired a lieutenant colonel, stated to us over and over again when we first found him in 1990. Don't ask me that. I'm still sworn to secrecy. And no matter how often we tried to focus on specifics regarding the case, I'm sorry, can't discuss it. I am still sworn to secrecy.
You know, I've had that happen to me over the years on stories, and I don't know how to describe it because, to me, that probably would not be an overbearing thing if I saw something just incredible and I wanted to talk about it. But to many people, this secrecy oath and their allegiance to the country and to the military is overbearing.
Well, I mean, as you know, even former news anchor with NBC, Tom Brokaw, described them as the greatest generation. They certainly did know how to keep their secrets. That World War II, you know, generation, as far as, you know, when it even came to winning that last World War, they knew the importance of keeping their mouth shut.
So this was ingrained in this generation.
They came out of that war, and it was just a continuation on that very theme. These were first of all, we're distinguishing the difference between the military and the civilian witnesses involved. Now, we'll get into that in a second. But the military, all it took was, you know, getting them to, you know, swear, I'm never going to talk about this again. And as it turns out, most of them did take this to their graves. They just, you know, they died with it. They died with the story of the millennium. But for those who felt, well, I need to at least tell my family, I at least need to go on the record and admit something before it's too late. And there's power in numbers, as you know, Jerry. And as a result, it also forces the issue. Because, after all, this is just a mobile weather balloon. There's nothing top secret about this any longer. So force their hand. Force their threat of retaliation or loss of pension or even worse. Because, you know, the Catch-22 is certainly greater for the government. Because if there were to be any retaliation, this would open up such a can of worms that, you know, likes we have never seen before. Because they'd have to acknowledge that it was something much more sinister, much more a threat to national.
Yeah, that's a good point. If somebody lost the retirement, put in jail or whatever, and they made it known public, that was a reason, because they talked about Roswell, that's a tacit admission that there's something there.
Something much more important than a weather balloon. But with the civilians, I think it's one of the reasons that they had to enlist the local sheriff in Roswell. They had to get the press on board. And they became, you know, actually complicit in these threats. The fact that with civilians, you can't threaten, obviously, loss of pension. You can't give them a military order. So in their cases, and we have many examples of how they were physically threatened, how their very families were threatened with loss of life, because they were talking about
it. Yeah, evidently the sheriff, the mafia would have done him proud.
It was the commission to basically go from house to house, and you better do as Harry told you or else, because, you know, you better accept your threats as being legitimate, because, you know, they said they'll kill your family if you ever talk about this. And it destroyed Sheriff Wilcox. It was something, he didn't run for re-election right after this. And as the family described to us, it destroyed him. He couldn't get over the fact that he was used, you know, for that very purpose.
Do you think he realized at the beginning he was being used, or just after re-election?
Well, the two daughters who lived right upstairs from the courthouse, that were the living quarters for the sheriff and his family at that time. When Phyllis McGuire and Elizabeth Talk, the two daughters, independently described to us, hearing one particular day right after, you know, this had pretty much calmed down, after the balloon explanation had, you know, taken effect, and they heard a swarm of vehicles surrounding the courthouse, and they describe how MPs came in from, you know, each door around the sheriff's office. And how they stormed into their father's very office and demanded, you know, that he turn over that box of debris, one of the boxes that the rancher Matt Brazzo had originally brought in to his office, you know, on Sunday, July 6th. And they pretty much strong-armed him, as they describe and witness. And just the thought of the military strong-arming a law enforcement agent. And I'm sure his spirit was just devastated from that moment, because this was now after he had cooperated, after he had served, as you describe, as practically a mafia hitman, in securing the cooperation of the civilian populace within Roswell. And he never got over that. So I think he thought that maybe he would have received some accolades and praise for securing the cooperation of the Roswellians, you know, throughout the community. But that was not the case. was not the case at all.
In fact, it appears to me, maybe you're a lot closer to the case than me, but it appears to me that the government didn't really pat anybody on the back.
No. I know there were some cases. We've had some MPs who talk about having been promised rewards up to $10,000 for their cooperation. And even like Melvin Brown, who was one of the guards involved with the bodies, about the crash site. And on his deathbed, he even gave his family a bank security number that supposedly was entrusted him, you know, for his assistance at the time of the incident. And when we checked out such a number, it didn't exist.
I want to talk about Melvin when we come back. We'll take a break, so don't go away. The 60th anniversary Roswell Jerry Pippen Show t-shirt is now on sale. A limited amount of sizes, medium, large, and extra large, are still available. But they are going fast. This t-shirt is made of fine fabric, 100% ultra cotton. And the design of the alien skull will astound you and others around you when you wear this t-shirt for casual wear. Hurry, supply is limited. $15 plus shipping at shopjerrypippen.com. What actually did Melvin see?
Brown was with the K-Squad. He was with the kitchen squad at Roswell, and we always found that curious. But first of all, I have to describe how at the Roswell Army Airfield in 1947, it was the first atomic bomb squadron, the 509th Atomic Bomb Wing. So everyone there had a top security clearance. If you so much as swept the floors at the PX, you had a top security clearance. Just was the nature of the beast at that time. And it was something that, as we were piecemealing and we were shotgunning the search for witnesses, even starting back in 1989, and we were wholesaling entire squadrons, obviously the MPs, the medical squad, that type of thing, certainly all the office. But we quickly discovered that that was not the case, that they piecemealed, that they selected individuals from this unit, that squadron, this group, for a reason. Because after all the dust clears, you go back to your respective squadron, you have nobody to compare notes with, nobody to talk to. Because you were the lone individual who was selected from, like in Melvin Brown's case, from K-Squad. And he was hand-selected, and he was sent out to the very crash site. And what he described to his family before he died was that he was assigned to ride back in one of the trucks, one of the medic trucks. And he was told to keep his eyes forward, not to pay any attention to the cargo underneath a canvas tarpaulin. And the first chance he got, he pulled back the tarp, and there were a number of the bodies. And obviously he was very shocked. He had no expectation that that was, you know, what they were transporting back to the base. And it was that many years later that it was actually the first manned landing on the moon in July of 1969 that he took the occasion of admitting this to his wife and two daughters. And they kind of poo-pooed it off. And then in 1985, when he was actually on his deathbed, he brought it up again and kept repeating over and over that it wasn't any weather balloon. I was there. I saw it. I saw the body.
Did he tell his family what they looked like?
Yes, he described them as under, you know, the darkness of the truck. That the skin was oddly textured. Whether that was a result of decomposition or not, one can only guess, but that the skin was already turning dark, but that clearly they were little people, that the heads were larger disproportionately to the rest of the body, and bodies were rather spindly.
You know, all of the people tell basically the same story.
The little people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that should add some credence. As I mentioned to you when we did our show at the Cover Up Cafe in Roswell, you guys laid this out in this book pretty well. If you're in court, you'd probably get a conviction on circumstantial evidence alone.
Alone, yes. And when we think back, I know the skeptics always come back to this, well, you only have circumstantial evidence. Well, many a person has been executed with nothing more than circumstantial evidence. I mean, if it's enough to put someone to death, it certainly should be enough to at least, you know, get some type of a ruling in a court of law. And especially deathbed testimony, as we were just describing with Melvin Brown. And this growing number, and as you were alluding to early into the program, Jerry, how we're getting more and more of these reluctant witnesses, unfortunately, that they're passing on. Certainly the attrition rate for the World War II generation only intensifies. But much to the credibility of our research and investigation, we're getting more and more of these deathbed testimonies. And invariably, they're not only describing, they're not only swearing that indeed the incident did happen, but that there were bodies recovered. Little people. Little bodies, as they describe.
What about the story of the one living E.T. or two?
We describe the, we have actually two first-hand witnesses, and the one that we describe in the book, Elias Benjamin, who describes being at the hangar, P3, Building 84, and that is the B-29 hangar that all the witnesses involved in either securing the wreckage or the bodies describe on the far east end of the tarmac of the base. And Benjamin describes how they were on guard duty at that very hangar and were aware of, certainly the remains of the ship, the debris scattered all over the floor. And there were a number of bodies on gurneys being ready to be transferred over to the base hospital. And they were ordered to actually remove those bodies and transfer them to the hospital. And he described to us how, as they approached the hospital, one of the sheets, one of the coverings, pulled away. And he saw that whatever it was still alive. That it was moaning, that it was kind of rocking and moving from side to side. But the shock of what he observed is something that still remains with him to this day.
Have you gotten anybody that was at the hospital?
Well, we know the story of the mortician, Glenn Dennis.
Yes. Yeah, we've had Glenn on, and he's told us the story. And about the nurse.
Going to into the hospital and being confronted by the nurse, and then later her describing what had happened. We have secondhand testimony, which we describe in the book, of the base hospital administrator's private secretary, Miriam Bush, who was taken into an examination room. And secondhand, her too being shocked for what she first thought were children, and then she quickly realized that they weren't children, they weren't human. And then there too, she described to her family, who we've interviewed, that one moved, that she was just as quickly alarmed to see that not only were they not human, but there was a survivor, that one was moving.
And I wonder how they treated the living one. I mean, how would you treat an extraterrestrial? Is there any medical records? I guess there has to be someplace.
Of course there would be. But one of the things that always, you know, intrigued us was that the base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, was a devout Catholic. And we've always questioned the manner by which he would have even treated the bodies. And it's come to light more and more within the last number of years that the base chaplain was even called in to give the last rites to those bodies.
Interesting.
So,
Now, when we talk about this living entity, did it go to Los Alamos or go to Wright-Patterson, or do we know?
Well, all the information suggests that everything went via Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, and additional flights would go on to Washington. We've even heard that some of the autopsies, for example, were done at Bethesda. in Washington, D.C.
Well, that would make sense.
That they would have had certainly the most sophisticated, most advanced medical facilities at that time. But regarding a survivor, one can only speculate. It's not like they were given a seat on one of the planes and transported, you know, off the base. It really kind of ends in Roswell. And I know there have been rumors and even the testimony from his sons of the Black Mac Magruder, who was with the War College at that time, and describing that they were sent as a group to Wright Field shortly after the incident. And we're shown the survivor. We're shown the living crewman from the crash just a few days before. So it again seems that everything, that Wright Field became the main repository for all the evidence, including the survivor. But as far as what became of it, we hear rumors of it dying within weeks or within a short, or within a few years after the incident. But
can't really pin that down. Why do you think after 60 years the government is reluctant to even admit anything?
I think it comes down to, and you've heard me say this before, I hate to sound like a stuck record, but I still am convinced it's a cover-up of ignorance. They still don't know what they're dealing with. They still don't know from why, from where, from who.
Well, I kind of agree with you. I've come to the conclusion after decades of doing these shows that the government doesn't really know too much more than we do in many instances.
And I think it's still certainly a very political.
I mean, because it was highly compartmentalized and not everybody knew.
And not everybody knew, and certainly not everybody knows.
And so they don't even know where to look for the records.
Even look. My concern is, and it continues, that the old order has not passed it down to the new. I've seen so many examples of officers within the military today, and as you just described, Jerry, they wouldn't even know where to start looking. They've heard this, you know, these rumblings all these years, and you know they'll be assigned to a specific base, and you know every base has its rumors, and one of the, you know, the predominant rumors has always remained that yeah, we have physical evidence, we actually got our hands on one, and we have the body secured someplace. And there may have been a survivor, but where to look and where it is today, they couldn't tell you. So there's this growing faction within the military. Yes, they would love to see this all come out. But unfortunately, as I described at the beginning, the program, that most have taken this to their grave. And the grave is the greatest arbiter of silence of all.
You know, it may not even be so far out, but I've often thought that perhaps these records are hidden in some place that you would not think about looking. In other words, if they wanted to keep a real secret, you wouldn't keep it in the National Archives or whatever.
I think Alcatraz is, you know, the greatest example of you know, containment. And it's one of the reasons that we've often, you know, speculated as to some of the islands, South Sea Island, where you have just total containment. And I know it's been speculated about some of the mountains within, you know, Nevada and up through Utah, that you also, if you go underground, would have complete containment. But again, I mean, we can all speculate, we can all come up with, you know, these scenarios of how something like this would be perfectly, you know, vaulted, kept for all eternity. But it still always comes back to just that you pose the question, why? Why do they feel the need now after 60 years to still bury this? Well, you know, again, one of the biggest stories of all time, and we're being denied, you know, the truth. And it's no different than when I posed the question to the late counterintelligence officer Sheridan Cabot. And I praised him for his patriotism, for his, you know, maintaining his security oath after all this time. And he thanked me. And I went on, I said, but Colonel, I still have to ask you this. What gives you the right withholding it from my generation? From all of us who weren't even born in 1947, you people have decided for all time that we're not, you know, to have access to the truth. And he stepped back and he paused. I've never thought of it that way before. But then he came back with the retort, but I'm still not going to tell you.
And so you have to have had decades of frustration here.
Truly. But no less than the people who were actually there. And when we were talking about memory and the fact that does time cloud, you know, their recall, their recollection of such an event. And the best example I can cite for all of us who certainly know exactly where we were and what we were doing is on November 22nd of 1960.
Right, the Kennedy assassination.
We will never forget any one of us.
That's a good point about if they saw an extraterrestrial crash, that would be implanted forever.
It embedded in their minds forever. And the point is, with the Kennedy assassination, most of us weren't there. Most of us, you know, only learn of it through the news reports and what we watched on TV that weekend. But we will always remember. But just think of those who actually were involved. And as though that should ever fade from their memory. No, I'm not a subscriber to this notion that as we get older, especially if it's a very profound experience.
Yeah, I don't remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah, precisely.
I can tell you that since I'm an older guy now. Walter Hout, I want to talk about him. And they left due to constraints in the publishing business. They left part of your story out. I want to talk to you about what maybe they didn't print. I'll be right back.
The American Southwest, a land of abandoned stagecoach stops, crumbling ghost towns, obscure, overgrown wagon trails, all ghosts of an exciting and romantic past. But amidst the hogback ridges and desolate expanses of the Four Corners region, stories float about of secrets, whispers of extraterrestrial spacecraft, intruding galactic visitors from other worlds, underground facilities, and above top secret recovery operations. Come now on a journey through this prehistoric land as we visit several locations where some of the most guarded secrets of the modern age have alleged to unfold. Along the way, we will speak with some of the most respected investigators, reporters, authors, and lecturers in the field of UFO research.
Fallen Angels, the DVD that shows the mysteries that haunt the desert Southwest. Order Fallen Angels today from ShopCherryPippin.com.